Illuminati, the 7-day theory, came out less than 2 months after his death and was released under his alter ego, Machiavelli, a shout-out to Renaissance-era Florentine politician Niccolo Machiavelli, best known for his book The Prince, which offers advice on power and leadership. Machiavellian may be shorthand for cynical manipulation for personal gain, but Tupac had found inspiration from the writer. Machiavelli, according to Tupac, said if you live your life how you should live your life, instead of excelling, then you're not living your life at all. You're a fool. Said to have been recorded in 7 days, the album doesn't feature leftovers from his previous work, but rather was intended as a standalone release. It captures magic from his frenzied post-prison recording sessions, like on the classic To Live and Die in L.A., and his songcraft was clearly still developing, as evidenced by his layered wordplay on this and later posthumous albums, though the production and engineering on those works is hit or miss. But often the Machiavelli album is a buzzkill, with shots levied against Haitian Jack, Jimmy Henchman, Mobb Deep, Biggie, Puffy, and even Nas, though they'd settled their beef before Tupac died. It's music to rage and spar by, when it was time to grieve and reconcile. I knew Tupac the human being, who wrote Tupacalypse Now and Me Against the World, not the tortured, broken beast who wrote Machiavelli, said Shock G from Digital Underground. I don't recognize my friend Tupac Shakur on Machiavelli. That's someone else. Mutual distrust. Tupac's murder should have been a slam dunk case. He was a huge celebrity shot down on a crowded street with eyewitnesses galore. So why hasn't it been solved 20 years later? Some blame the Las Vegas Police Department. Their investigation was characterized as sloppy and indifferent, or worse. Former LAPD investigator Russell Poole had a chance to examine their clues and concluded that they hadn't sufficiently followed up important leads. Department members, however, blamed the witnesses' code of silence. It amazes me that when we have professional bodyguards as part of this entourage, that they can't even give us an accurate description of the vehicle, lead Las Vegas police investigator Sergeant Kevin Manning told gathered reporters. Suge Knight himself adhered to the no-snitching rule, famously saying he wouldn't reveal Tupac's killer even if he knew, because I don't get paid to solve homicides, he told reporter Brian Ross. But a number of Death Row affiliates did talk. We all told the police that a white Cadillac came up and an arm reached out the window and started shooting, Edie Amin said, who was in the car behind Tupac's. It happened so fast that no one could get an accurate description or a license plate or anything like that. EDI claimed another reason they didn't help police much is because investigators didn't seem particularly interested in what they had to say. I believe neither the police nor the Death Row affiliates tried hard enough to bridge the gap between them. This atmosphere of mutual distrust began fermenting immediately after the shooting, when police threw Suge, EDI, and others on the ground, assuming them to be the perpetrators. The police were doing what they thought they had to do in that moment of chaos, but in the process fatally harmed their investigation. I think they went through the motions, and that they would have liked to have solved it, said former LAPD investigator Greg Kading of LVPD. But you've got this built-in dynamic that leads itself to alienation and separation, as opposed to groups coming together to solve the crime. Suge emerged as a prime suspect. Tupac was planning to leave Death Row, goes this line of thinking, and murder was his punishment. That, or a way to capitalize on the believed hundreds of unreleased tracks he might have taken to another label, had he lived. Kevin Hackey, who worked as Death Row security, fingered Suge in the Nick Broomfield documentary Biggie and Tupac. Another bodyguard, Frank Alexander, also believed Suge was involved with the murder, citing all the hurdles thrown in his path when it came to guarding Tupac in Vegas. No phone, no reinforcements. Detective Russell Poole suspected Suge facilitated the Orlando Anderson stomping at the MGM to make it look like Tupac's killing was simple retaliation. These theories sound far-fetched to me. It's counterintuitive that Suge would have put himself directly in the line of fire. 12 or so bullets came into the car after all. It's possible that Suge later intimidated Orlando Anderson. At the death row leader's parole hearing, Anderson reversed his previously stated assault allegations against Suge, insisting that Suge had actually been trying to help him during the MGM Grand stomping. Anderson's attorney said he changed his testimony out of fear of Suge. Anderson later received a settlement from Tupac's estate, owing to Tupac's part in the assault. But the stomping seemed to happen so spontaneously. It's hard to imagine something so chaotic and brutal in a public place could have been orchestrated. Finally, if Suge wanted Tupac dead, he could have found much cleaner and less risky ways to do it. I also take issue with another theory, later championed by Russell Poole. It involves Suge's wife Sharitha and death row security head, Reggie Wright Jr., who supposedly wanted Suge dead to take over his assets. They, the theory goes, enlisted a group of three men, including Long Beach rapper Little Half Dead, a death row affiliate. His motivation for supposedly killing Tupac? He'd actually recorded Brenda's Got a Baby first, and Tupac stole it from him. While Poole was a committed detective, this theory is excessively complicated and implausible. The accused deny their involvement. Death Row bodyguard Kevin Hackey further claimed FBI agents were in the Death Row Las Vegas caravan that night and saw Tupac's murder. This added fuel to the belief that the government was involved in the death, a claim made explicit by addiction and mental health counselor and author John Padash in his book, The FBI War on Tupac and Black Leaders. The FBI, after all, long had it in for the Black Panthers and their affiliates. I also don't believe this explanation holds up to scrutiny. Bargaining. There is, however, a theory that may have legs. Though Tupac harbored a long list of enemies, two parties in particular had major pressing beefs with him: Orlando Anderson and Bad Boy Records. Detective Greg Kading has implicated them both. An LAPD homicide and gang investigator who'd previously worked in South Central, Kading in 2006 was assigned to a case that would lead him to Tupac, and he later led a task force looking into Tupac's murder that teamed up with the FBI and DEA. Tupac's slaying was allegedly solicited in L.A., which gave Kading's team jurisdiction. Eventually, their work led them to a Southside Crip named Dwayne Keith Keefe D. Davis, a Compton-based PCP dealer and the uncle of Orlando Anderson. Keefe D., who was in Vegas with his nephew at the time of Tupac's murder, gave a statement to the FBI in 1997. In the statement, he said he and Anderson were uninvolved with the killing and suggested Suge was responsible for Tupac's murder. More than a decade later, in interviews with Kading's task force, Keefe D. changed his tune. As detailed in Kading's 2011 book, Murder Rap, as well as the documentary of the same name, Keefe D., now facing many years behind bars after a drug bust, called his prior story bullshit. He now claimed that Puffy had offered him $1 million to murder Tupac and Suge. Keefe D. and his crew hadn't come to Las Vegas that weekend in pursuit of Tupac, he added. They'd come for the Tyson fight. Orlando Anderson arrived in a white Cadillac, which had been rented by the mother-in-law of another member of their party, Keefe D. said. But following Anderson's assault, a man named Eric Zip Martin allegedly stepped in. He was an associate of Puffy's, also there for the fight, and according to Keefe D., Zip suggested the occasion might be the perfect opportunity to complete the $1 million contract. In fact, Keefe D. said Zip even gave them his Glock, which he just happened to have with him. The group drove to Club 662, and waited for Tupac and Suge for a time, before deciding to venture back out to the streets. They were alerted to Suge's BMW, near the Maxim Hotel, by the screaming female fans who joined the caravan. They did a U-turn, and it was Orlando Anderson who pulled the trigger, Keefe D told the investigators. Orlando rolled down the window and popped him. If they would have drove on my side, I would have popped them. Then, after escaping the car full of Death Row's enforcers, they parked the Cadillac near the hotel and went back to the room to drink and smoke weed. Keefe D and company never did get their $500,000 for completing half of the job, he said, which is part of the reason he was now giving up Puffy to Kading's investigators. He'd also been promised immunity for his confession. Keefe added that Biggie was never involved. Puffy vehemently denied the allegations. This story is pure fiction and completely ridiculous, he told LA Weekly in 2011, after Kading released his book. Indeed, there are many reasons to doubt Keefe D's claims. He'd already changed his story once. He's been in prison numerous times and was bargaining for his freedom. Even if Keefe D was telling the truth, there is no one to validate his claim that the bad boy mogul offered him $1 million for the murders, given that Keefe D said the men were alone when it happened. However, there were others pointing a finger at Puffy. In the murder rap documentary, Kading cited a Southside Crip informant who told police that Bad Boy had a standing $1 million contract with the Crip set, with which Orlando Anderson and Keefe D were affiliated. It's unclear if this was allegedly for the murder of Suge and Tupac, or just Tupac. Former president of Bad Boy, Kirk Burrows, claimed in a 2003 lawsuit that Bad Boy was suspected to have hired Tupac's killer, but didn't elaborate. The case for Orlando Anderson as the trigger man is highly compelling. Police reported many anonymous tips suggesting as much, and just about everyone I talked to in the hip-hop community believes he did it. But even if he were the trigger man, it's possible he shot Tupac as a direct response to his beating, rather than as the result of a wider conspiracy. One person who cannot weigh in is Orlando Anderson. He was killed in 1998, less than 2 years after Tupac's murder, following a shootout at a Compton car wash. Police deemed the incident unrelated to Tupac's slaying, but Anderson's name will forever be linked to the rapper, though he was never charged and denied his involvement. Anderson left four daughters behind. His troubled past included a string of arrests, but he wanted to turn his life around through music, starting a rap label called Success Records, with his half-brother Pooh, and building a home recording studio. Journalist William Shaw visited the spot and spoke with Pooh, who proclaimed Orlando's innocence in the Tupac case, said he'd segued out of gang life, and called him the most charismatic person that I ever knew. Other associates of Anderson's thought his early death was not particularly newsworthy. After all, Anderson, like Eazy-E, attended Dominguez High School in Compton. There, as Shaw points out in his 2000 book, West Siders, the yearbook contained a full-page ad for a local mortuary. Chapter 24. Trepidation and Bravado. According to his manager, Mark Pitts, Biggie Smalls broke into tears at the news of Tupac's death. He could hardly believe it. After all, his one-time mentor had been shot before and lived to tell the tale. But perhaps there was a bright side to the tragedy. With Tupac dead, could that mean all of this was over? In 1996 and early 1997, Biggie was working on his second album, Life After Death, whose title, he said, alluded in part to Tupac's passing. Biggie had started on the new work a few months before Tupac's murder and was extremely proud of it. As popular as he'd become, he felt his new album would really put him on the map. But there was stress in Biggie's life, too. By early 1997, his weight had swelled to over 350 pounds. Owing to a recent car accident, he walked with a cane. Weapons and narcotics charges hung over his head, following a July 1996 raid of his Teaneck, New Jersey home when police found guns and marijuana and his relationship with Faith Evans was flagging. If that wasn't enough, he was nearly broke. And so it was with a weird mixture of trepidation and bravado that he arrived to California in February 1997. He came to record, shoot a video, do press, and work Hollywood channels in hopes of kicking off an acting career, as Tupac had. But the agenda also included smoking some of that excellent Cali herb beneath palm trees to try to get his mind off things. For a few weeks, it worked. Puffy put him up at the Los Angeles Four Seasons, and he gave interviews by the pool, just like in Juicy. He joyously hit the town with his friends. Life was too short to live in fear.
"We were proceeding like things were back to normal again," said a member of his entourage, speaking anonymously to a Newsweek reporter.
"Was it too soon? You didn't have to believe Bad Boy orchestrated Tupac's death to think it a tad disrespectful for Biggie and his crew to be acting like they owned the place.
Anybody in their right mind knew they didn't let enough time pass," said promoter Doug Young.
Biggie's mind was unsettled, but he could take solace in a couple of things. For one, he'd found God. Encouraged by Puffy to make things right spiritually, he acquired a Jesus medallion and got a piece of scripture tattooed on his arm. For another, on February 12, 1997, Puffy and Snoop declared a truce in the East Coast-West Coast beef, albeit in the unlikeliest of venues, at a press conference in L.A. before the taping of an episode of Steve Harvey's self-titled WB sitcom. Employing some rather wooden acting in the show, Puffy and Snoop are brought together by Harvey's teacher character to deliver a message of peace to his class. But there were bad omens as well. Boos, surely stemming from the coastal rap rivalry, rained on Biggie when he presented an award to singer Toni Braxton at the Soul Train Awards on March 7th, where Tupac's All Eyes on Me won Album of the Year. The less-than-welcoming reception at the show didn't stop Biggie from attending a post-awards party at the Peterson Automotive Museum the following evening, in L.A.'s Miracle Mile neighborhood. He almost didn't come for another reason. Puffy had arranged a London promotional trip for him, but Biggie talked his boss into canceling the trip.
"The food is horrible," he explained in part.
He believed the Peterson party might provide some good networking opportunities. Indeed, celebrities crawled the event. The New York-based DJ made everyone comfortable, playing Biggie's new single, Hypnotize, and other Bad Boy songs. Biggie in shades and his Jesus piece chilled at a corner table, while Puffy, wearing a bowler hat, got loose on the dance floor. At one point, the people around him started chanting, "Bad boy, bad boy." But the West Coast got shout-outs too. When the DJ played California Love, everyone put their drinks up in the air, even Biggie. Eventually, the fire marshal shut the overcrowded party down. Surrounded by his posse, Biggie limped toward the exit.
"Get down."
Located just across the street from the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, the Peterson sits at the corner of two busy streets, Wilshire and Fairfax. The Bad Boy caravan consisted of three vehicles, with Puffy's at the front, and the rear car driven by security guard Reggie Blaylock, an Inglewood police officer. The middle vehicle, a GMC Suburban, pulled up to the museum to load Biggie into the front passenger seat. Though they'd considered attending yet another party, feeling fatigued, they decided to turn in. But traffic was jammed, and they inched along. At the corner, just as the light was turning red, Puffy's lead car squeezed through across Wilshire, while the Suburban, blasting Life After Death, was forced to stop. In a scene eerily similar to the one on Flamingo Road in Las Vegas, a car pulled up next to Biggie's vehicle, a green Chevy Impala. A gunman fired about 6 shots from a 9mm pistol into the passenger side.
"Get down!"
yelled Corrupt, a few cars behind with his fiancée, Foxy Brown. Hearing the shots, Puffy jumped out of his car and ran to Big Side. But his star rapper was already losing consciousness. He'd been shot 4 times, in the arm, back, thigh, and hip, the last proving fatal, as the bullet hit vital organs. Blaylock chased the Impala, but couldn't keep up. Biggie was rushed to Cedars-Sinai, the same hospital where Eazy-E had died 2 years prior. There, the larger-than-life rapper was pronounced dead shortly after 1 a.m. He was 24, 1 year younger than his one-time ally Tupac. Former New York Mayor David Dinkins and rap stars including Dr. Dre attended Biggie's March 18, 1997 funeral on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, where Faith Evans sang gospel and Puffy delivered a eulogy. Mary J. Blige consoled Lil' Kim as they exited. Following the service, thousands gathered to mourn and celebrate him in Brooklyn, as his motorcade, drenched in flowers, passed through the streets where he grew up. In the wake of Biggie's murder, life after death took on a horrible and sinister new meaning. In an ad that came out after his passing, he was seen standing next to a tombstone. It became one of the best-selling rap albums ever, going diamond platinum in 2000, 14 years before All Eyes on Me did the same. Rumors flew in every direction in the weeks that followed Biggie's killing. Many suspected Suge's involvement, despite the fact that he was in prison. But police were instead chasing leads that tied the death to Crips, supposedly over a financial dispute. This theory would maintain a lot of traction over the years, considering Bad Boy's ties to the Southside Crips, and the fact that Keefe D and affiliates were at the Peterson that night. Many explanations were floated. Perhaps Bad Boy owed the gang money for security work, or the gang was simply extorting them. Perhaps the label unceremoniously cut ties with them after Tupac's death, thinking they no longer needed their services, and angering them in the process. But this hypothesis wilts under scrutiny. For one thing, neither Lil C's nor G Money, members of Biggie's entourage and eyewitnesses to his murder, recognized Keefe D nor any other Crips as the shooter. For another, according to Lil C's and Bad Boy bodyguard Eugene Deal, Bad Boy's interactions with the Crips contingency were nothing but cordial that evening. LAPD detective Russell Poole dismantled this theory and developed one of his own, with a conspiratorial bent that threatened the entire department. Poole discovered foul-smelling death row connections to cops, including David Mack, a Compton-bred Olympics-caliber middle-distance runner whose career was ended by injury. Mack found success as an undercover officer, but was arrested after stealing more than $700,000 from a Bank of America branch in late 1997. Mack's police partner, Rafael Perez, was also thought to be in cahoots with death row. His corruption arrest and testimony would fuel the costly LAPD Rampart scandal of the late 90s, revealing widespread misconduct in its crash unit, the same unit infamous for aggressively rounding up anyone in South Central whom they took to be gang members. Poole was shocked to discover David Mack had something of a shrine to Tupac in his garage, right next to his Impala SS, the same model as the one used by Biggie's murder. But Poole didn't think Mack pulled the trigger. His theory accused a friend and former classmate of Mack's, named Harry Billups. Billups was now a Nation of Islam member, who went by Amir Muhammad. This detail seemed especially incriminating, as witnesses said Biggie's killer wore a traditional Muslim suit and bow tie. Information police received from a jailhouse informant seemed to finger Amir Muhammad as well. Further, Bad Boy bodyguard Eugene Deal later said he'd seen Muhammad at the Peterson on the night in question. The LAPD stymied Poole in his investigation, He believed it was to cover their own. Transferred off the case, he resigned from the department in 1999, and before long went public with his investigation. Poole's theory informed Randall Sullivan's 2002 book, Labyrinth, and Nick Broomfield's Biggie and Tupac documentary that same year. Poole also worked closely with Biggie's mother, Valletta Wallace, on a wrongful death lawsuit she and others filed against the city of Los Angeles in 2002. It was amended 5 years later to allege police conspiracy in Biggie's murder. The suit was potentially worth $500 million, the rapper's estimated lifetime earnings, a sum that apparently terrified LAPD brass. That's why the cold case was reopened in 2006, said Detective Greg Kading, who had come to lead a task force investigating both Biggie's and Tupac's murders. Kading's team soon dismissed Poole's theory. For starters, the Impala murder car was green, rather than black like the one David Mack had. They also looked more closely at the accusations of the jailhouse informant who had supposedly fingered Amir Muhammad. It turned out the informant described someone with very little in common with Muhammad. As for bodyguard Eugene Deal's alleged sighting of Muhammad at the Peterson that night, Deal had previously ID'd someone different, Kading said, and besides, Muhammad's picture had already been published in the media, which might have tainted Deal's recollection. Ultimately, neither Mack nor Muhammad were charged in the matter. A theory. Kading's task force hoped Keefe D might be able to break open the Biggie case. Initially, Keefe D wasn't talking. And so in 2008, they successfully set him up on a massive PCP bust. After offering immunity, they questioned Keefe in great detail about the night at the Peterson, but he soon let them know they were barking up the wrong tree. "That wasn't us," Keefe said, soon unfurling his story about his, Orlando Anderson's, and Puffy's alleged roles in Tupac's killing. Kading's team was back at square one when it came to Biggie's murder. They attempted to resurrect an old FBI racketeering case against Death Row, seeking to tie the label to money laundering and drug trafficking. That effort was unsuccessful, but it did connect them with a key witness, the mother of one of Suge's children, named Teresa Swan, a pseudonym given to her by Kading. She, like Keefe D, was successfully leveraged for information by Kading's team, owing to possible charges against her for bankruptcy fraud and involvement in an auto theft ring. They used her to confirm a theory they had. That theory? That Suge had Biggie murdered because he believed, erroneously, that Biggie had given to the Crips the gun used to kill Tupac. Kading's team believed an associate of Suge's named Wardell Pucci Faust killed Biggie. A jailhouse letter from a gang member named Roderick Reed, whose co-defendant had been close to Suge, espoused as much. Adding fuel to the theory was that, before Biggie's murder, Suge was believed to have purchased a green Impala for Pucci, the model and color of the murder car. The investigators weren't able to talk to Reed, but they were able to turn the screws on Teresa Swan. They did so by creating a fake confession letter from Pucci, which purported to lay out his arrangement with Suge. Murder Biggie in retaliation for the killing of Tupac. The letter also implicated Swan herself as a conspirator in the crime. To make it look more authentic, we put a fake law firm letterhead and redacted out certain sections, Kading said in the murder rap documentary. They dated it April Fool's Day. Of course, getting Swan to turn against Suge was no small matter, owing both to her personal loyalty to him and his fearsome reputation. But after being assured that the department would do their best to protect her, she broke down.
"What Pucci said, that's what happened," she told them.
She added that at Suge's behest, while he was behind bars, she met with Pucci to discuss the plan and arrange his payment of $13,000. Death Row security head Reggie Wright Jr. told Kading
that he was correspondingly asked by Death Row's general manager about a way to get a large quantity of cash to one of Suge's female friends. Swan told investigators she attended the Peterson party, but did not witness the murder herself. Not long afterward, when she met Pucci to give him some of the money, his Impala looked like it had been repainted, she said. Pucci himself could not be part of Kading's investigation. In July 2003, he was murdered in Compton while riding his motorcycle. That case also remains unsolved. Greg Kading's task force produced compelling leads in the murders of both Tupac and Biggie. The case for Suge's involvement in Biggie's murder seemed solid, and they were attempting to link Puffy more directly to Tupac's murder as well. To do so, they were hoping to set up Puffy's associate, Eric Zip Martin. He was the alleged link between Keefe D and Puffy, and the man believed to have given the .40-caliber Glock to Keefe D and Orlando Anderson in Las Vegas, the same gun that killed Tupac. Since Zip was a narcotics dealer with whom Keefe D had previously done deals, the task force planned to have Keefe D try to set up a new drug deal with him. Then, with Zip's back to the wall, the thinking went, he might be willing to cooperate and testify against Puffy. Zip's loyalty to Puffy likely wasn't what it once was, considering the two of them had reportedly fallen out. But it was not to be. In 2009, superiors removed Kading from the task force. He claimed it was owing to an LAPD internal affairs investigation of his work on a different case that year, against grocery store chain owner George Torres. Torres's federal murder and racketeering convictions were overturned, owing in part to police misconduct. The judge ruled that Kading threatened and bribed witnesses. Though Kading was ultimately cleared by internal affairs, he said he felt disenchanted about how the events surrounding the Torres case played out and retired from the department in 2010. Still, even without Kading, the Tupac and Biggie investigations could have continued. But LAPD brass put the task force on the shelf. The LAPD said, "We're going to take everything we have on Tupac's murder and just give that to Las Vegas PD and let them decide what they want to do for that case," Kading told me in 2016, adding that they simply reassigned the remaining Biggie investigators to work on other murders. Kading can only speculate as to why the LAPD gave up. He believes it was because his task force had debunked the cop conspiracy theory at the heart of Valletta Wallace's lawsuit, the one advanced by Russell Poole. And since the department had thus insulated itself from the lawsuit, the task force was deemed non-essential. They might also be worried, Kading speculated, that a savvy defense lawyer would play up the witness tampering charges against him to tar any case the LAPD brought. At the end of the day, he said, the LAPD no longer desired to commit the energy and resources to proving and prosecuting the cases. The fact that they failed to put to bed the biggest murders in rap history wasn't much of a concern. They just made a decision on the immediate circumstances and didn't really think, well, how do we look down the road? Kading said. I reached out to LAPD for their side of the story multiple times, through numerous channels, but did not receive a response. A spokesperson for the department told People in 2016 that they wouldn't comment on the findings of Kading's film, Murder Rap. Travesty of justice. Every year that passes, more potential leads dry up. The Biggie and Tupac murders are growing increasingly difficult to solve because the key players keep dying. In 1996, Yaki Gaddafi of the Outlaws, Tupac's childhood friend and a witness to his slaying, was murdered in New Jersey, not long after Tupac. It was deemed unrelated. In 1997, Heron, one of Suge's closest associates, and one of the participants in the Orlando Anderson stomping, was killed. In 1998, alleged Tupac triggerman Orlando Anderson was killed. In 2002, Buntry and Hendog,
Two more of Suge's closest friends and Death Row employees were killed. Bunchry also participated in the Anderson stomping and was in the car that followed and exchanged gunfire with the white Cadillac following Tupac's shooting. In 2003, alleged Biggie trigger man Wardell Poochie Fouse was killed. 2003 also saw the murder of Anthony Wolf Jones, Puffy's bodyguard, and the man believed by some to have murdered Suge's friend, Jake Robles, whose death escalated East Coast-West Coast tensions. In 2012, Eric Zip Martin, the associate of Puffy's who allegedly provided the Glock that killed Tupac, died of natural causes. In 2013, Tupac's bodyguard, Frank Alexander, killed himself. Also in 2013, another Tupac bodyguard, Michael Moore, who was also in Vegas at the time of the murder, died of a drug overdose. In 2015, Russell Poole, the former LAPD investigator who alleged a massive police conspiracy in Biggie's death, died from natural causes. Also in 2015, Terrence T. Brown Brown, who Keefe D. said drove the white Cadillac in Vegas, was killed at a medical marijuana dispensary. If this was Elvis Presley and Frank Sinatra who got murdered, there would have been arrests a long time ago, Russell Poole told journalist Jeff Weiss shortly before Poole's death in 2015. This case can be solved, but needs police follow-up. There are clues sitting right in front of the police. It's a travesty of justice. Valletta Wallace's wrongful death case was dismissed in 2010. But with the news came a hopeful sign. A lawyer for Biggie's estate claimed the police's case had been reinvigorated. But Captain Kevin L. McClure of LAPD's Robbery Homicide Division dumped cold water on that theory. "It's always been considered an open investigation," he said. When asked if the police were close to catching Biggie's assailant, McClure replied, "Probably not." Epilogue. While most figures in the hip-hop community were devastated by Biggie's murder, a minority of rap fans were actually pleased, including some in the Bay Area, Tupac's one-time home. Some sadly celebrated Biggie's death, claiming that it was just revenge for Pac's death, wrote San Francisco radio personality Davey D. "Now folks back east know how it feels," was what many said. Others, however, were worried the carnage had only begun. Behind the scenes, a series of under-the-radar gangland revenge plots had been set in motion even before Biggie's murder. On September 9, 1996, 2 days after Tupac's shooting, with the rapper clinging to life support, a suspected Southside Crips leader named Darnell Brim was shot in Compton. A 10-year-old girl was also hit by a stray bullet, but both survived. The shooter was set to finish Brim off, but decided not to upon realizing Brim had fallen atop the girl. Over the course of the next 5 days, more than a dozen more people were shot, three of them fatally. The incident seemed tit-for-tat. According to a police search warrant, the Mob Pyrus aligned themselves with other blood factions for the battle, and the Southside Crips joined forces with other Crip subsets. The gang truce of 1992 was a distant memory. There's no evidence that these slayings were sanctioned by anyone from Death Row or Bad Boy. It seems plausible that kids in the streets were simply anguished about Tupac's murder, and the subsequent revenge killings created a sinister domino effect. "There are very few Compton gangs that have leaders," said Reggie Wright Jr. "These youngsters, they kinda respect you and call you OG, but if they're going to do something, they're gonna do it." Soon Compton police, responding to the chaos initiated by Tupac's slaying, and working in conjunction with other departments, obtained warrants to raid nearly 40 homes in Compton and nearby cities, and locked up dozens of gang members. The trouble with what Pac was doing with this East Coast-West Coast thing was that it was just something got out of hand,
a publicity thing. But brothers in the street think something is really going on, and they're gonna die for it, said rapper Big Syke from Tupac's group, Thug Life. Pac was like a person starting a fire, and it got out of control. After Tupac's and Biggie's murders, there was, for a time, probably no more terrifying profession in America than high-profile hip-hop artist. Rumors abounded that Ice Cube, Mac 10, or Puffy could be hit next. Bi-Coastal group The Firm recorded their debut album in neutral Miami because no one wanted to go to the other's neck of the woods. Particularly frightened was Snoop Dogg. Though things should have been looking up for the rapper after he beat his murder charge, Snoop was drained of his resources, and his label mate had been brutally murdered. His own potential enemies seemed to lurk everywhere. Snoop's role in the East Coast-West Coast conflict was hard to pin down. Following the Red Hook Brooklyn shooting during the filming of the Dog Pound video in 1995, he stomped on Big Apple skyscrapers in the New York, New York video. But he also showed love for Biggie and Puffy, appearing on the Steve Harvey Show with the latter and sending a loud message that he wouldn't be involved with Death Row's war. That didn't stop him, however, from siding with the label in its divorce from Dr. Dre. Snoop's sophomore album, The Dogfather, released in November 1996, features the mildest of disses against his former benefactor, asserting that he didn't need Dre's beats to be successful. It's no doggy style, but the underrated Dogfather offers nice tracks from Daz, DJ Pooh, and others. It hit number one on the Billboard 200, but it would be Snoop's Death Row swan song. Like Dre, he believed the gangland culture was getting out of hand, though he partly blamed his own crew. But it was more than that. He believed Suge didn't tolerate disloyalty, and that things could get ugly quick. The Summit. Owing to a history of anti-Semitic remarks, Louis Farrakhan gets little respect in the mainstream media. The Nation of Islam leader has long maintained unrivaled admiration throughout the hip-hop community, however. During the 1990s, when national leaders, black and white alike, were distancing themselves from rap music and culture, Farrakhan spoke out on its behalf, offering hospitality, counsel, and protection to embattled stars. Even today, hip-hop celebrities seek him out. In 2015, Kanye West announced he was making a documentary about the minister and his pre-Nation music career. Shortly after Biggie's death, Farrakhan conceived the granddaddy of all rap meetings, helping ensure no less than the very survival of the genre itself. To do so, he undertook a seemingly quixotic notion. He sent out invitations to everybody in rap who hated each other, and he invited them to his house. After a few preliminary regional meetings to set the stage, the players arrived in Chicago on April 3, 1997, for talks at Farrakhan's extravagant home in Hyde Park called The Palace. The invited rappers were told to take off their shoes, common practice for Muslim homes. Those in need were provided socks. They also met at the Salam Restaurant, a Nation of Islam-run eatery in Auburn Gresham, which adheres to Muslim dietary restrictions. The assembled included representatives of the East, West, Midwest, and South, of the Old School and the New School. The summit addressed hip-hop beefs, including the lingering animosity between Ruthless and Death Row Records, which continued after Easy died. Bone Thugs and Harmony's album, E-1999 Eternal, took shots at the Dog Pound, who retorted by calling them holes in harmony. It's easy to find MCs to execute, Corrupt rapped. Taunted by Death Row members at a club, Busy Bone said they nearly came to blows. But tempers were dampened in Chicago.
Corrupt came at me, he was like, that was some bullshit, Busy said,
adding that they went on to become tight.
These niggas is my best friend right now.
If the minister wasn't there, and it was held somewhere else, someone might have gotten put down, said Corrupt.
Ice Cube had lots of explaining to do. He arrived on a chartered jet from a movie set, with numerous scores to settle. He quickly quashed disputes with his affiliates Cam and Shorty. But many New Yorkers were pissed about his album, with West Side Connection, Bow Down, which had come out in the fall. Bronx rapper Fat Joe in particular couldn't understand why Cube was antagonizing people in a city where he'd previously had so much love, dating back to America's Most Wanted, and even his NWA work.
"When I heard you were gonna be here, I got in my car and drove 15 hours just to see the whites of your eyes," Fat Joe reportedly told Cube. "I wanted to see you face to face and ask you why you did what you did."
Cube, flanked by his West Side Connection colleagues Mac-10 and Dub-C, asserted that New York media didn't show L.A. rappers proper respect, and that its artists tarred gangster rap as a bastardization of true hip-hop, ignoring the fact that New York artists like Wu-Tang Clan and Fat Joe himself made hard-edged rhymes. Cube admitted stirring up some controversy on purpose. After all, battling is an essential part of hip-hop. He and Joe hashed things out, with Cube ultimately admitting that considering the current volatility, perhaps it was time to tamp things down a bit. It wasn't Cube's only beef. He also faced hometown hero, Common, whom he insulted on Bow Down track, Who Bangin', WSCG style. "I'm bombing on common sense, Chicago is mine, nigga hit the fence." But they reconciled as well. Cube stood up and gave him a hug. "It was a great thing," Cube told me in 2015, adding that, as a measure of how far they've come, Common stars in the latest version of Cube's Barbershop franchise. Common credited an atmosphere where they could speak one-on-one, without yes-men and hangers-on in their ears, talking crazy. At his summit, Farrakhan sought to put the hip-hop acrimony in historical perspective. He handed out copies of the so-called Willie Lynch Letter, a guide purportedly written by an eponymous white slave owner in the early 18th century, advocating pitting slaves against each other as a method to control them. Though its historical efficacy is in great doubt, the document served as an effective metaphor for the state of the rap industry, where black artists' beefs with each other were driving sales in the largely white-controlled music and publishing industries. Hip-hop magazines in particular were accused of perpetuating coastal beef, including Vibe, which published a 1995 issue with Biggie and Puffy on the cover, alongside the headline, East vs. West. Vibe's president, Keith Klinkscale, admitted to not giving proper consideration to community concerns, though he defended their journalism. Puffy couldn't be in Chicago for the meeting, but pledged his support. Ghetto Boys rapper Willie D condemned the mainstream media's ongoing breathless critique of his art form. Famed activist Kwame Ture also spoke to the group. A heroic effort, considering he had prostate cancer and would die a year later. He talked on J. Edgar Hoover's attempts to infiltrate and disrupt black activist groups, and suggested the same tactics were still at work today. Other rap notables present at the summit included Chuck D, Goody Mob CeeLo Green, Too Short, who did some soul-searching about his lyrics, and Harlem beatboxing legend Dougie Fresh, who lamented the state of a genre whose initial goal was to spread unity and good times. Another crucial organizer of the event was Def Jam co-founder Russell Simmons, who discussed leading a bi-coastal concert tour. Both he and Farrakhan went on to host subsequent truce meetings, and Simmons founded the Hip Hop Summit Action Network, which works with the rap industry to effect social change. The East and West have come together, and they have agreed that as of this day, all of the insults that have been heaped on one by the other will cease, and each have forgiven each other, Farrakhan announced at the press conference that concluded the summit. Though the meetings didn't generate much mainstream coverage, that wasn't the main point. The point was to extinguish hip-hop violence. Considering its marked decline since then, the event
was an unqualified success.
The proof is in the history, said Corrupt.
No limit. At the press conference, Snoop stood behind Farrakhan before delivering a passionate address himself. But the Chicago summit didn't end his troubles with Death Row. He came to Loggerheads with his agent and manager Sharitha Golden, then known as Sharitha Knight. As Suge's wife, she was in a decidedly difficult position to represent Snoop. Golden declined my request for an interview for this book, but in 2016, she told S. Lee Savage, "I'm very open and honest with everybody," in regards to her management style. In 1997, Sharitha sued Snoop for $1.6 million in unpaid agent commissions. That is 20% of the $8 million he'd earned since she began working for him 4 years earlier. Snoop claimed to be blindsided. He, along with Dr. Dre, David Kenner, and Suge, sued their accounting firms, the same ones who employed Death Row's embattled accountant, Steve Cantrock, and he claimed he was unaware that signing with Death Row meant the boss's wife got $1 out of every $5 he made. He extracted a sizable settlement, but buried in Sharitha's lawsuit was the eye-raising claim that Snoop was deathly afraid for his life. The defendant presently owns and oftentimes travels in an armored van equipped with gun ports, it read, adding that Snoop was paying large sums of money to have 24-hour armed security force and maintains a large entourage to travel with him. Snoop denied this was the case, but he had cause for worry. According to an interview he later did with police, he believed Suge was responsible for Tupac's murder. He'd also surely heard the rumor that Suge ordered Biggie's head. Could Suge be coming for Snoop next? Into this uncertainty, Master P came riding in like a white knight. A son of the New Orleans Calliope Projects, the man born Percy Miller established his No Limit record label in the Bay Area before returning to Louisiana to kick off one of the most remarkable runs in hip-hop history. No Limit sold grimy, street-centric albums as fast as they could print them. And in 1998, Master P pulled off the seemingly impossible. He signed Snoop away from Death Row. It helped that Suge was behind bars and financially pinched. It also helped that Master P, a fearsome child of poverty himself, wasn't afraid of him. In Master P's recollection, the negotiations were surprisingly simple. He asked Suge how much Snoop was worth on the open market, and then offered him a little bit more.
"That's it," Master P said. "The money will be there in the morning."
Snoop promptly relocated, joining Master P and artists, including Mystical, in a Baton Rouge-gated community called the Country Club of Louisiana. Considering Snoop's parents had grown up in Mississippi, the South wasn't new to him. Though the Country Club denied the No Limit guys memberships to use the tennis courts, Snoop was nonetheless comforted by his new surroundings, about as far from coastal animosity as he could be, physically and psychically.
"Master P was willing to step up," Snoop said. "I needed that more than a record label. I needed a friend."
Snoop's three albums with No Limit sold well, though they aren't particularly well remembered. But his Louisiana stint helped him successfully transition to the satisfying next phase of his career, reuniting with Dre on the blockbuster Chronic 2001 album and starting a label of his own, which kicked off with the appropriately named Paid the Cost to Beat a Boss. Despite his relocation, Snoop's relationship with Suge continued to disintegrate. Sure, as required, Snoop denied that he lived in fear.
"Never was afraid of him," he said of Suge. "I was afraid I was gonna have to kill him."
Still, he had reason to believe the Death Row leader was coming for him. Suge called Snoop a government informant and made thinly veiled threats. Not long before Suge's 2001 release from prison, Death Row's website proclaimed, "2001, the year of fear. All dogs run and hide. Suge is coming home."
The message was followed by a dog barking, then a gunshot. But a funny thing happened. Instead of fighting fire with fire, Snoop chose nonviolence. Having witnessed firsthand what headstrong armed devotion to your set, be it a gang, record label, or even a coast, entailed, he sought a different path. Going to be okay. Following the Farrakhan peace treaty, Ice Cube also began to reassess his priorities. Somewhere along the way, he concluded that he didn't always have to be the hardest guy in the room. During his early 20s, Cube made a habit of pissing people off. The years since have shown a full reversal. Nowadays, Cube seems to thrive off diverse friendships and business pursuits. The first time I talk with Cube, it's at the Westwood W Hotel in 2013, an interview hosted by his new sponsor, Coors Light. Like many of his film roles, his commercials for the brand trade on his tough guy persona for comedic purposes. In one, he faces off against a bottle of the suds over who is the coldest, and ends up with a face full of frost. In person, he's polite and deferential. His bulky frame housed in all black, from his skate shoes to his Dodgers hat, he quickly commences with the beer shilling, and indicates he's down to talk about whatever. We hit many topics, including his ESPN documentary on the Raiders, for which he interviewed owner Al Davis shortly before his passing. He looked great for a man that was about to die. His own work ethic. My wife will tell you when I'm not busy, I'm antsy. And why gangster rap gets a bad rap. How many serial killers listen to classical music? They never blame classical music. He talks about his love for mid-century designers, Charles and Ray Eames, whom he learned about in his Phoenix architectural drafting studies, and whom he celebrated in a 2011 video for the Getty Institute. His career continues to evolve, even as he continues to draw snickers from some for having transitioned from hardcore hip-hop to soft multiplex fare. The punchline of Cube jokes almost always involve, "Are We There Yet?", a 2005 family comedy in which his character battles pissing, barfing children. In one scene, a deer karate chops him. The film was a huge success, earning $82 million at the box office and inspiring a sequel and a television series, but is just one spoke in Cube's Hollywood empire, which also includes the Friday, Barbershop, 21 Jump Street, and Ride Along franchises. I once read someone speculate that, had Cube been killed instead of Tupac, the former would have been the hardcore martyr, while the latter would have eventually segued into PG movies. Sooner or later, one has to ease off the throttle. To reinvent yourself is no small thing, and Cube's mogul status gave him the platform to push the Straight Outta Compton film, which did more to revive NWA's legacy than anything else. Jerry Heller has called NWA the Black Beatles. Their meager output makes it hard for me to co-sign this characterization, although it's fun to think about. Cube is John, Dre is Paul, Ren is George, and Yella is Ringo. But who is Easy? George Martin? Perhaps a better comparison is with NWA's contemporaries, Guns N' Roses, with whom they shared mutual appreciation and an LA fan base. Lead singer Axl Rose was often spotted wearing an NWA ball cap, and the rapper's song, Appetite for Destruction, was inspired by GNR's album of the same name. Both acts pushed boundaries and were considered politically incorrect, even harbingers of doom in their times. In the end, they remade their respective genres, and today are radio staples.
We thought we were so badass, said Axl Rose in 2006. Then NWA came out rapping about this world where you walk out of your house and you get shot. It was just so clear what stupid little white boy posers we were.
Oddly, NWA's leader Eazy-E doesn't command near universal appreciation
like rappers Notorious B.I.G., Nas, Jay-Z, Tupac, Eminem, and Dr. Dre, most of whose styles can be directly traced to what Easy started with, the Boys in the Hood. He is the founder of gangster rap, Crazy Bones said.